Local newspaper coverage in South Central Indiana has been in steep decline with the shift in ownership from a family-owned company to a company controlled by large private equity firms. This story is an overview of WFIU's reporting on the topic, with funding help from the Poynter Institute and the Omidyar Network. WFIU's Bob Zaltzberg has this first report in a series we're calling Paper Cuts.
The disintegration of local newspapers in South Central Indiana shows up in staffing, circulation, and local news content. Some declines began under family-owned Shures Communications Incorporated, but the free fall began early in 2019 after SCI sold its publishing division to Gatehouse Media and its private investment firm owner, New Media Investment Group. The newspaper's relationship with local communities changed too. Todd Shures was president and CEO of the Indiana-based company then. He says, of course, the company wanted to make money, but its core mission was tied to journalism and serving communities.
It was very journalism-based in terms of presenting facts, helping people get to the truth, and then how people can use that to make a better community, a better society, a better nation. So very idealistic was what the mission was, but it was very core and it was very journalism oriented.
Private equity owners have one primary goal: to maximize profits. Tim Franklin grew up in Mooresville, Indiana, and graduated from Indiana University. Now he leads the local news initiative at Northwestern University's Medill School of Journalism. He notes that private equity firms argue that they're saving some local newspapers by buying them when the family owners want out of the newspaper industry and might otherwise shut them down. But there's another more damaging side to that argument.
Private equity is there for return for their investors. And that they are going to harvest the assets of these local news organizations for as long as they can, and that they're not really invested in the communities in which they own these publications. And I think that, you know, we're seeing this effect kind of all over the country.
Ryan Gunterman is a former Bloomington High School North teacher who has worked in journalism education for 20 years. He says ownership matters.
I think it matters when it comes to their true commitment to the organization and a mission. And when your mission is profit, and when your mission is for your stockholders to be happy, that doesn't always necessarily lead to, you know, great things.
Academic and industry groups have studied the ownership issue and cite various effects when the profit goal dwarfs community leadership. Government operates unchecked, important issues go uncovered, corruption can increase, taxpayer spending can become reckless, and voter participation can diminish. Gatehouse went on to take over Gannett, the largest news. Welcome to Noon Edition on WFIU. This is a special program today, live from the Monroe County History Center. I'm your host, Bob Zaltzberg, along with co-host Sarah Whitmire. And today we're going to talk about the effect of private equity control on local news. Before we begin, let me just say that this show is a preview of a reporting project called Paper Cuts that is exploring how private equity control of newspapers has affected communities in South Central Indiana, and solutions being discussed to bolster local news coverage. So I want to start the program today and ask Nicholas to be our first speaker, just to answer, if you could, in a minute or two, give us a primer on private equity and, you know, when is it good and when is it maybe not so good?
Well, thank you so much, Bob, first of all, for the invitation of being here part of the panel, and give my chance to basically address my opinion. Well, private equity basically is more or less considered as a tool for, I would say, profit maximization. So you have private equity firms going basically into various industries, and what they do is they try to basically maximize profits, right? And there are various ways they can do this. They can either like cut costs, they can try to like increase revenues by expanding, I don't know, products, or, you know, like try to, I mean, a lot of times you see in the news, obviously, also the reports about like staffing and like, you know, you're saying reducing staff and using basically those measures to generate more profit. And they have high incentives to do so because they have option like contracts. So they basically get compensated on the upside that they make on basically don't really get punished for losses. So you have these strong profit maximizing incentives that these companies or these private equity firms have, and then they are running funds, so they're basically collecting money that is coming from investors such as large pension funds. They're heavily invested in private equity. We have endowments. So I use endowment, for example, is also heavily invested in private equity. And that money is more or less managed by these private equity firms, and they go in all industries. I mean, they've bought the UFC in 2016. They go into fracking. They are heavily invested in the gun industry. They are invested in news. They're basically invested in anything you can think of. And the question is, are these always, you know,
always good? Always bad.
Always good, good or always bad. Yeah, it can vary.
Okay, I want to turn to Sarah Vaughn next. Sarah's been the lead reporter on this. So, you know, we're based in Bloomington. We talk a lot about Bloomington things. What have you found in your reporting that strikes you about, you know, this South Central Indiana region? Just a couple of top line thoughts.
That we actually do have news deserts in the area. I've talked to former newspaper reporters in Lawrence County and Owen County, and they use that phrase to describe their situation. And news deserts is a term that's been coined by researchers to designate an area that doesn't have a comprehensive source of local news. And what's happening in those places, there are some reporters who are spearheading an effort to, like Nicole I see in the audience, who are spearheading news startups, you know, and that's a real brave task given the funding issues in rural counties. But also, you know, the thing that common people, I'm sorry, not common people, but, you know, the everyday citizen and politicians and everyone is also battling is the who's rushing in to fill the gap. It's often well-meaning or possibly slightly slanted folks who are trying to fill the gap with information that may not be as reliable as you would get from a reporter who's had training in journalism ethics. And so, you know, we've talked to politicians who are concerned because they're having to educate the public themselves when they call up and complain about something. They've seen something online that hasn't been reported factually. And so, you know, there's a lot of battling mis and disinformation in the counties that we looked at, which was Monroe, Lawrence, Owen, and Morgan County. And again, in Morgan and Owen, there are former Gannett employees who are, or in Nicole's case, a former Gatehouse employee, who are taking the bull by the horns and starting new startups so that they can provide that really essential local government coverage as well as the high school sports coverage that everyone craves, right? So there are hardworking folks out there trying to fill the gap with, you know, ethical reporting, balanced reporting.
Yeah, and let me say, you know, from our seats up here, we're not trying to criticize any local reporters who still work in this ecosystem. They're doing the very best they can with a lot fewer resources. Jason, when you look at the local news scene, I know we shared a panel once in Bedford to talk about local news down there a few years ago now. You know, what are your top line thoughts about what's happening in the local news business?
Yeah, I mean, it's a common story, of course, what we're witnessing here in southern central Indiana. The consolidation of, or attempted consolidation of a lot of these news organizations, newspapers in particular, that have been longstanding, and not just newspapers folding, of course, but just being gutted, downsized, and the phrase ghost newspapers. I know the conversation before we were on air, that came up, and I think that's very true of a lot of places. So maybe it still is there, technically, but it's maybe perhaps a lot of the reporting is pulled from other places and just, you know, fill the pages. from, say, Indianapolis in a local paper. Those sort of things happening. So a shell of what it once was. And that's concerning in the sense that if we think about the implications of this, I mean, accountability is certainly an important part of local journalism, and a lot of people, I think, yearn for that and can easily see the value of that. But just in the sense of having a sense of place and connection and kind of contributing to the social fabric of some sort of community, I think that is one of
Welcome to a special noon edition program live from the Petty Pit Stop Cafe in the Holman & Sons building in downtown Terre Haute. I'm your host, Bob Zaltzberg, along with co-host Max Jones, the editor of the Terre Haute Tribune Star. And we're going to talk today about Wabash Valley Resources plans in Vigo and Vermilion counties. John, I've got a couple follow-ups that have actually come in to me here. Cool. One is somebody wants to know, Who pays for your services? How do they know that you are impartial? You're an employee of Indiana University now, right?
That would be, I'm a state employee, so I was a university employee.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So, and then the other question is, has come in, that says, you say CO2 storage has been happening for decades. Have you seen a project of this scale and injected into this kind of geology?
So the two projects I mentioned, the Arthur Daniels Midland projects over in Decatur, Illinois, are the analogous scale-wise. And so you have to think about rate. And this project, as proposed, is over a multi-year time, so it's a similar kind of rate. And so the ultimate volumes would be similar to the kinds of things that were evaluated and assessed over at ADM.
Okay. Max, do you have
just one follow-up also for you, Professor Rupp. In terms of the way this is regulated, what is really required? What's important for people to know that are concerned about this, about how the regulation takes place? Who's in charge of the regulation? And is that something that people should be able to trust as being done properly?
So the regulation is quite complex, depending on where in the capture, conveyance, and sequestration stream you are. I'm going to defer to my colleagues. They may want to talk a little bit farther upstream about whether on the capture side or the pipeline side, who and what is the regulatory body for those. So for the well itself, that's regulated by the EPA, the reservoir, and the seal. This is the EPA under their underground injection control program. So this is Region 5 out of Chicago. So that's just for the well and the reservoir and the seal. It's important to remember that the UIC program is a part of the Safe Drinking Water Act, and this is only statutorily over the protection of groundwater. So in terms of other aspects of concern about what was the long-term fate of the CO2, how could it be used for other things, those are outside the purview of the EPA's permitting. The pipelines are In our state are regulated by the IURC's Pipeline Safety Division, and they are in coordination with the Department of Transportation, PHMSA, or Pipeline Hazardous Materials Administration. That's a federal agency. So there's a myriad of agencies, both federal and state, that handle some of that. And I'm sure there's other clean air things, IDEM things, that are up, further upstream.
Greg, you're taking notes,
yeah.
I see.
Well, so I was going to just correct in the in our pipeline, it'll be regulated by the DNR. So I had the same question about why it's not IURC, but the statute has it regulated by the Department of Natural Resources. It is in coordination with the rest of the state, so that, you know, there'll be other people that they can rely upon, but that's just a quick correction. I kind of wish it was the IURC.
Okay, Kerwin, do you?
Yeah, well, I'm glad pipelines came up because we're also very, very concerned about pipelines and pipeline safety. And with respect to the regulation of CO2 pipelines, that is incredibly vague and unclear, even by the admission of PHMSA. We have the federal government right now drafting new rules for the regulation of CO2 pipelines. That draft rule will not be available until October 2024. That's a draft rule, not a final rule. We also have a rulemaking process that will begin at some point at DNR related to what CO2 regulation will look like in the state of Indiana. But right now, that is an industry-only private working group at DNR where the public is not invited into that conversation. So we have no idea what those CO2 rules will, pipeline rules will look like in Indiana. And so when we know we're not going to have federal rules till at least 2025 at the earliest, when we know we're probably not going to have state rules until at least 2025 at the earliest, and keep in mind, these are rules to govern the regulation of CO2 around the safety to the public and the health and safety of communities. It is fundamentally irresponsible and unfair, we believe, to allow the construction and the transport of CO2 pipelines unless and until the federal agencies and the state agencies in charge of putting in place health and safety standards for those pipelines have those promulgated and finalized. And so they're putting the cart way above the horse here. And we have no idea how CO2 pipelines are going to be regulated. It is exceptionally vague, exceptionally unclear, and that's worrisome to communities.
Greg, can you respond to that?
Well, a little bit. I think, you know, in your question that came in about the professors, who pays him, you know, you can already hear the, let's say, the public concern. They don't necessarily trust the government. So I was in the government for 25 years. They don't trust science. So I think the opportunity to raise fear among the public is out there just with the lack of trust in the programs and the policies that have been developed over the last 25 years. So the last three administrations in Washington have all seen carbon sequestration as the way to reduce our carbon emissions into the atmosphere. And anybody who's concerned about the climate and some of the issues dealing with carbon really should be focused on these policies. But we're already committed to carbon sequestration. Nobody's getting a new permit to emit huge amounts.
There were a lot of shared priorities between Republicans and Democrats in both chambers this year, and several of those issues had been building for years or even decades: access to mental health, affordable housing, and perhaps the biggest, public health. The governor and legislative leaders generally agreed on what was needed.
And I'll cut to the chase. It's going to take dollars.
By adequately funding public health.
It's a historic investment, I think.
Beyond the money, there was policy work to be done, specifically how the money for those priorities would be used. On mental health, the path forward seemed pretty clear. Invest in local community health centers and a 988 crisis response line and get people with mental illness out of jail and into treatment. The consensus around that was exemplified by people like Jody Mosier. She shared emotional testimony with lawmakers about her brother, who was killed by police while experiencing a mental health crisis.
None of those things should have been a death sentence for my brother. It doesn't matter if you are black or white, if you are rich or poor. Everyone in this state can benefit from this type of bill.
Consensus was more challenging on the public health side. After 2 years of study by a commission, lawmakers set out to dramatically expand the services and resources offered by local health departments. Yet some legislators balked, expressing a fear, even if unfounded, voiced by Elkhart County Commissioner Brad Rogers.
I hear testimony today, I've been standing out there, I've heard the testimony, that there are no strings attached. But I'm not sure I believe that yet.
Still, the bill's language was repeatedly sharpened to ease such fears, and the measure ultimately attracted broad bipartisan support. The same cannot be said for the legislature's attacks on the transgender community. With one bill, Republicans trumpeted parents' rights as they sought to force schools to out students to their parents when the student requested a name or pronoun change. Parents, students, and educators, such as Evansville science teacher Suzanne Glass Foster, said the measure would cause harm.
This bill would stop teachers from responding to students in a loving and...
After a brutal work week, a group of colleagues is sitting around a table inside a dark room in western Indiana. Topless women take turns around a pole on a tiny stage. Others mingle closer to the men. The men work for the United States Bureau of Prisons. Tonight, they're celebrating a major accomplishment, something no one in their line of work has pulled off in a generation: killing three people on federal death row in a single week. And a warning, this story contains explicit language and descriptions of violence. The celebration doesn't last long. In the coming days, health officials will discover that one of the dancers tested positive for COVID-19 before a shift. A week later, one of the prison employees tests positive. A week after that, the club shuts down. Before long, health officials trace the prison worker cases back to the dancer. By the year's end, as a result of lapses like this one, the Federal Correctional Complex in Terre Haute, Indiana, will become the epicenter of the coronavirus pandemic in the federal system. But tonight, nobody knows any of this, and the public won't hear about it for a long time. They'll hear the opposite again and again. In the weeks leading up to that night, U.S. justice officials were saying, often under oath, that every possible thing is being done to prevent the spread of COVID inside their facilities. They've been telling judges and journalists, even the families of crime victims, "We have a plan. Everything is under control. It's safe here." But that wasn't true, and it wasn't the only risk they were taking.
Live from NPR News, I'm...
When the United States started executing people again.
The United States government held its first execution in 17 years this morning at the federal penitentiary in Terre Haute, Indiana.
All federal executions in this country are conducted at one place, the Federal Correctional Complex in Terre Haute, Indiana. But they've been extraordinarily rare. Until that summer, there hadn't been a single execution carried out by the U.S. government in 17 years. It just wasn't something America really did anymore. But when that changed in summer 2020, the U.S. Justice Department didn't just resume carrying out death sentences. It started executing people faster than any administration in modern history.
For the second time in 48 hours...
For the third time this week,
the federal government executed an inmate...
During those first few days alone...
A third inmate is scheduled to die Friday.
Fourth one carried out by the federal government this year.
The federal government would soon match the total number of executions in the previous two decades combined. And they were just getting started.
Was the eighth federal...
Out its ninth federal...
For the tenth federal execution this year. Within days, the number of executions exceeded combined totals since the 1960s. Authorities blew past claims of intellectual disability, mental incompetency, ineffective counsel, racist prosecutions, even innocence. And they set other records.
The only Native American on federal death row.
Another three, including the only woman,
black inmate last night.
For the first time in the country's history, the United States government executed more people in a single year than in all 50 states combined. And by the time it's over, more executions under a single presidential administration in a century. I'm George Hale, a public radio reporter based in Bloomington, Indiana.
Testing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10.
And that's Adam Pinsker.
So, George, not recording or not yet?
I'm recording, yeah.
Okay, that's fine.
Adam's a TV news reporter in Indianapolis.
Call me naive, I didn't think it was going to happen.
But he used to work with me, reporting and hosting newscasts for WFIU, the NPR member station covering federal death row.
It just didn't seem possible at this point.
Yeah. Nevertheless, at 8:07 a.m. on July 14th, 2020, someone, person's identity still isn't clear, pronounced a man named Daniel Lee dead more than 4 hours after a group of also still mostly unidentified people strapped his arms and legs to a thin table.
It didn't seem real.
They poked needles and IVs into his arms and hands and eventually injected him with two doses of a sedative that's usually used to treat seizures.
Again, maybe it was like some sort of like denial that I was in.
And the U.S. Prison Bureau selected Adam to watch.
Not wanting to believe I was doing this, that I was covering this.
From WFIU Public Radio in Indiana, this is Rush to Kill. Each week, we'll take listeners inside the secretive Midwest facility where America houses its least wanted citizens, and where it gets rid of them. In this debut episode, how U.S. justice officials convinced top judges to sign off on a plan to kill 14 condemned Americans in the middle of a pandemic. A shaky legal theory that got the ball rolling, and how laws passed decades ago by people in power today made it all possible. And why it could happen again.
former Vice President of the United States, candidate for President of the United States, Joe Biden.
Joe Biden stepped up to a microphone in downtown Indianapolis.
Hello, everybody. How are you?
It's July 2019.
Good to see you all.
He's an early frontrunner in the Democratic presidential primary.
We have to defeat Donald Trump this time out. We have to.
Thanks, in part at least, to support from African Americans.
And then we have to work twice as hard to rip out the inequities that still exist for people of color, black people in this country, in housing, in health care, in criminal justice systems.
Most of the audience are black attendees at the annual convention of the National Urban League, which advocates for African Americans. The speech is Biden's latest opportunity to reassure black voters he's still the Joe they know.
The racial disparities are so pervasive in our society.
All he wants is to talk about the future.
So there's an incredibly long list of policies I go through.
But his opponents won't stop bringing up the past.
That 1994 crime bill, it did contribute to mass incarceration in our country.
Particularly one of Biden's signature achievements during his career in the U.S. Senate, the Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act of 1994.
It funded the building of more prisons in the states.
Often shortened to the 1994 crime bill, in recent political debates are simply the crime bill, Biden drafted the Senate version. When Donald Trump took office in 2017, federal death row held 60-plus people, 10 times more than the year before the crime bill passed, a direct result of the bill's vast expansion of the number of crimes and factors that could result in a federal death sentence. These days, many in Biden's party are skeptical of the death penalty.
That's the line, the portion they repaired.
I see. Could you, like, show me where in the driveway it is?
Yeah.
Hoosier Fiber Networks connected the home of Mike Sauer and his wife, Vanya Castro, to citywide broadband last January. Sauer said it only took a few weeks before the trouble started.
We started having some problems in our bathrooms. A lot of gurgling going on in the toilets when you flush them.
Sauer suspected the issue was related to recent fiber installation. When city utilities came out to investigate, they discovered contractors had drilled through his sewer line. The contractor responsible, Vertical Underground LLC, sent out a crew to repair the damage. Sauer said that fixed things for a time, but several months later, the problems resurfaced.
The week before Thanksgiving, when we were having, you know, guests come in from out of town, our entire family was coming here and the toilets are all backing up.
Now Sauer is at a loss. He worries that if contractors won't cover repairs, he could get stuck footing the $12,000 bill. Fiber installation is the largest underground infrastructure project in Bloomington since cable television. It will dramatically improve internet speeds and connectivity citywide. But Dave Broden, CEO of Hoosier Fiber Network, says Bloomington can be a challenging place for a project of this size.
An urban environment like Bloomington's very dense with underground infrastructure, and some of that infrastructure, including parts of the utilities, are frequently unmarked.
The city of Bloomington maintains over 420 miles of water main pipe, not including the service lines that lead into buildings. As Vic Kelson, director of City of Bloomington Utilities, told the Common Council earlier this month, breaks are usually caused when contractors misestimate the depth of pipes.
They know if I'm standing on top of it or not, but they can't be quite sure how deep it is because the land surface elevation does change with time.
According to James Hall, Assistant Director of Transmission and Distribution for the City of Bloomington Utilities, because soil composition is inconsistent, an inexperienced or unaware contractor could also end up drilling further underground than they realize. That was the case for a sewer force main contractor struck near Gentry Estates last month, causing waste to leak into a retention pond.
That sewer force main was between 4 and 5 feet somewhere, and they thought they were only going to be at 2 feet.
Broden says Hoosier Fiber Networks tries to cut back on this by getting rid of unreliable contractors.
Any subcontractor has multiple instances is typically removed from the project.
Dealing with pipe breaks can be frustrating for residents because it's not always clear who to contact. The city of Bloomington doesn't contract or pay the companies installing fiber, so it's not liable for accidents. Rather, it granted the French infrastructure company Meridiam the right of way to develop. Meridiam's local subsidiary, Hoosier Fiber Networks, oversees the entire project. But the actual installation is handled by a general contractor, AEG. AEG, in turn, works with subcontractors that dig, bore, and lay cable. In the words of City IT Director Rick Dietz, going to the city as a middleman is not usually the best route.
If you do notice there's an issue, you know, talk to the contractors in your neighborhood, talk to them, you know, immediately, because they will often address the problem, you know, at that time.
Hall says breaks can take weeks, months, or even years to become noticeable. The longer a resident waits to investigate drainage problems, the more difficult it can be to prove a contractor is responsible.
I think it's better for them to be more proactive than trying to be reactive maybe 18 months after when you're going to have trouble.